From the Denker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we'll feature a conversation with John DeGraff, co-author of the best-selling book Affluenza, The All-Consuming Epidemic, which looks at societal problems caused by the relentless pursuit of material gain.
Do we really want to bring everything into the sort of market world? Or do we want time and space for acts of grace, of sharing, of giving to each other? And I think when you look at happiness and well-being, what we understand is that we need to have more time for these things that don't have the price tag.
That conversation and your local news summary just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks once again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Later in the program, we'll have a conversation with John DeGraff, author of the best-selling book Affluenza. But first up, we have these headlines. A Utah Insurance Department official says it's too soon to say whether the state will allow or insurers will sell policies canceled under the federal health care law. President Barack Obama announced on Thursday that for one more year, companies could sell canceled policies that don't meet the law's requirements to current customers. The announcement followed news of waves of cancellation notices across the country in recent weeks. Utah Insurance Department Assistant Commissioner Tangi Northrup says Obama's announcement is, quote, a tremendous change with very short notice that her department is still reviewing. Northrup says the insurance department is still figuring out how they would handle the change, how it would affect insurers and rates, and what kind of burden it might put on people. In related news, only 357 Utah residents have been able to sign up for health insurance on the online federal marketplace that has been plagued by glitches and delays. The federal government released figures Wednesday showing a mere 27,000 people are enrolled for plans in the 36 states relying on the federal website. More people, a total of 79,000, have been able to sign up for plans in states running their own marketplaces. The total enrollment of 106,000 is about one-fifth the number the Obama administration projected would be enrolled by the first month. The insurance marketplaces are a key component of President Obama's health care law, which requires almost all Americans to have health coverage starting next year. The federal government also announced that 4,800 Utah residents are eligible for Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP. The Utah Attorney General's office has reached an agreement with state lawmakers over records the lawmakers requested as they investigate Attorney General John Swallow. Both sides are now asking a judge to approve the agreement, which allows state House investigators to access the records, but keeps documents that contain protected health information, tax records, and other information private. Utah lawmakers sought a broad range of records from the Attorney General's office as they look into allegations of misconduct that have surrounded Swallow since January. Earlier this month, Swallow's office said they were concerned about turning over records because some contained federally protected health information. Swallow has denied any wrongdoing and has pledged to cooperate with the investigation, which could serve as a precursor to a possible impeachment. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has decided against listing a prairie dog found in four southwestern states as endangered or threatened. The agency said Thursday that threats to the Gunnison prairie dog won't cause the animal to become extinct soon or in the foreseeable future. The prairie dogs live in grasslands and intermountain valleys of northern Arizona, southwestern and south-central Colorado, northwestern New Mexico, and southeastern Utah. Federal officials say that while outbreaks of plague have decimated some colonies, the populations have rebounded and are stable. The environmental group Wild Earth Guardians says the federal government has dodged its responsibility to protect a species that exists in 5% of its historic range. And those are our local headlines for the day. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. Now on The Rundown, we'll turn to our conversation with John DeGraff, executive director of the organization Take Back Your Time, as well as co-founder and senior partner of the Happiness Initiative. DeGraff co-authored the best-selling book Affluenza, The All-Consuming Epidemic, which looks at our society's relentless pursuit of material gain. DeGraff was here in Salt Lake City to give a lecture at the Hinckley Institute at the University of Utah. So, John DeGraff, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. The title of the speech you gave earlier today at the University of Utah was Happiness, Time, and Sustainability. And it's kind of an unusual question, but I was wondering if you could start off by telling us how you personally define happiness.
Oh, well, happiness, certainly I define in kind of the manner of Aristotle, Thomas Jefferson. It's an overall satisfaction with life when one's time is done. I think of one of my heroes, maybe my personal hero, a man named David Brower, who built the Sierra Club as an organization, founded Friends of the Earth. I knew him for many, many years and actually made a biography of him for PBS in 1990. I was with him a few days before he died, and I was at a hospital called Alta Bates in Berkeley, California. It was clear that the end was near. He was dying from cancer, and he was an old man. And as I was leaving, I wanted to lighten things up a little bit. So I said, well, David, I hope that next time I see you, you'll be out healthy again and fighting the good fight. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, John, I don't think that's in the cards, but it's been a great 88 years. I think that's what happiness, that's what we all want to be able to say whenever time comes. And I think that's about having meaning in our life, having made a difference in the world, having connections, being satisfied with life. It's not about momentary pleasure. That's not what I mean by happiness.
Well, and that's momentary pleasure is something that you have written about. You've written quite frequently about growth, consumerism, and you've called ours a society of stuff. And you know, many of us like to at least think that sustainability as a concept has become more and more at least familiar to people. But how we as a society measure health and success even is often through this lens of economic growth. Could you maybe touch on how that lens of growth defines the modern human era?
Well, absolutely. You know, when we think of the whole notion of growth and economic growth, it's a relatively new concept, dates back to the 30s and 40s when we first designed this thing called the gross national product or the GDP. Even the person who created it, an economist, Simon Kuznets, said that it wasn't a measure of the well-being of a society. It should never be seen as that. It was really a measure of the circulation of goods and services through the economy and the money spent on those in the course of a year, what was produced and what was spent. But that doesn't define what it was. But we have come to believe that we can measure our wealth as a society and how well we're doing by this single thing called the gross domestic product. And if it keeps growing, then we're doing well. The problem with that is it can grow in good ways and it can grow in bad ways. And those bad ways include cleaning up oil spills and all the messes that we make and stuff. All of that, when you have to do that, that actually adds more money to the GDP than if the oil made it to the refinery. So it's a very poor measure. But that aside, we simply cannot grow in a material sense without limit because we're already coming face to face with the limits of the biosphere. Since World War II alone, we have reduced our fisheries, our soils, our fossil fuels by something like half on this planet, so far as we know. We have created the extinction of countless species. We have used more resources than all human beings in all history did before that time. And what's very obvious, although there are still some Americans in denial, we are phenomenally changing the climate in ways that could be devastating to human civilization within the next century. So we have to figure out how we can have happiness without endless growth, because endless growth is simply not possible on a finite planet.
Well, and just from the kind of evaluative side, you know, how we measure our progress, are there alternatives to looking at growth to measure our own successes, to measure our society's success?
There are many alternatives in terms of measurement. A number of countries now are looking at alternative measures, and even the United States Obama has a group of people who are looking into what might be an alternative for the U.S. Some states in the U.S. Already are using an alternative model, which they call the Genuine Progress Indicator. In Maryland and in Vermont, the two first states to do this, that indicator includes about 26 items of well-being, ranging from environmental things to health things to leisure time to material affluence and all of those things, education. So that's a big start in the right direction. And other countries are starting to do things like that, too.
You know, you mentioned leisure time, and I've seen a couple of lectures where you talk about theories of leisure and how important leisure time is to our well-being, you know, both our health and our sort of mental stability. In some ways, it's kind of a no-brainer, but how have theories of leisure influenced the way that you look at these subjects?
Well, you know, I've always believed that we need time for these non-material things in life, time for, in the words of this old song, bread and roses, time for art, for love, for beauty, for all of these non-material aspects of life, for play, for nature especially, time to get out into those things. Now, as a society, we've become a very workaholic culture. We put all of our emphasis on that, plus the electronic technologies that make it possible for us to work all the time. You know, and it looks good on the balance sheet when you measure GDP because those things count. You spend money. Leisure, just basically having time off, is a waste of time as far as the GDP is concerned. So I think we're not taking into account what's important in this regard. And when you look at the impacts of work stress in America on our health and on our social connections and all of this stuff, it's immense. We really have to have leisure time. Now, that doesn't mean just time spent lying in the hammock, although no problem with that for some of the time. We need rest too, but it also means things like time to volunteer, time to learn, time to, again, get out in the natural world, time to exercise, time to eat right. These kinds of things, which are we're giving very short shrift to in our society, they create meaning and they improve health.
You know, I wanted to circle back around to sustainability. There's kind of a cult of growth, and in some ways it's unavoidable. It's just part of where we are, what our economics look like. I'm wondering if alternatives, you know, even as vague a term as sustainability, are gaining any traction in the face of the entrenched status quo.
Well, one person, I'm forgetting their name, said that things are getting better and better and worse faster and faster. So that in some areas, we're seeing some really big positive changes. There is a lot more thought about sustainability. We're starting to do smart things in schools about building and in other places in our society. People are starting to eat local food. We're starting to see an upsurge in small local farms and gardens and things. There's a lot of positive stuff that's going on. Unfortunately, there's also this constant push for more and more stuff, for more consumerism. There was the recent hideous Toys R Us commercial that mocks kids getting out into nature and instead says that, oh, that's stupid and boring, and what the kids really want to do is be in a Toys R Us store surrounded by plastic and grabbing all the plastic toys. These are these values that we are also promoting that are ultimately very dangerous. And clearly, the climate is not getting better. Our health is not getting better. So we're seeing two things going on. And we have to ask, where are our values around these things? What do we want? There's no argument between the Republicans and Democrats about growth. Growth is the thing everybody wants. The only argument is over, do you get that growth by austerity or by stimulus? Mm-hmm. Now, those are, in my view, two sides of the same counterfeit coin. Because if you're talking about austerity, then you have to ask a very simple question. Austerity for whom? Austerity for the people who are already making minimum wage, who can't feed their families, who are getting poorer and poorer, or austerity for those who have gotten, you know, fabulously rich over the past 30 years? That's a question. Then on the other side, the question is growth of what? Some things need to grow. We need to grow more community. We need to grow better education. We need to grow better health. But other things have to shrink, and the pure consumption of material goods is simply not sustainable over the long run at the levels to which we do it.
I'm wondering if instead of abandoning the concept of GDP growth, I mean, conceivably, you could have economic growth while at the same time reducing the material consumption of resources.
Well, it is possible, you know, if you bring more experiences into the market and charge for them and things like that, yeah, you could have less impactful GDP growth. And we do. We're already doing some of that kind of stuff. So a dollar added to GDP doesn't have quite the same impact each dollar, it still has an impact, but not as much as previous ones, because we are getting a little technologically more sophisticated. We have more energy saving device, you know, we have things that can improve this. But in the long run, then we have another question, and this is the great social philosopher Ivan Illich brought up, which is, do we really want to bring everything into the sort of market world, into the cash world? Do we want to have every experience that people have be something that they buy and sell to each other? Or do we want time and space for people to have those things as completely acts of grace, of sharing, of giving to each other? And I think when you look at happiness and well-being, what we understand is that we need to have more time for these things that don't have a price tag.
Well, but, you know, there are people out there who are trying to sell you happiness, you know, to actually put a price on happiness. Money must have some kind of effect on your well-being. And I guess the question is then, you know, from somebody who's studied this academically, can you buy happiness?
Well, you can buy slight, you know, I mean, you can spend differently and make yourself happy. You can have the same amount of money, and how you spend it will have an impact on your happiness. And there's certainly a lot of scientific research that shows that spending money on experiences, taking a vacation, traveling and stuff will give you more long-term satisfaction, life satisfaction of the type I'm talking about, than going out and just buying another appliance. That's true. But ultimately, no, I don't think that just more and more money if there were no other costs, but there are other costs. The usual cost of having more and more money is working longer hours, often is getting into debt in order to borrow, those kind of things. It's impacting your health and so forth. So there really is a point of diminishing returns when it comes to more and more money.
We've been touching on the idea of happiness. Maybe you could tell us what the Happiness Initiative is. You know, what its goals are and how it came to be.
Sure. People can find the Happiness Initiative at the website happycounts, counts.org. And that's a survey that was based on the little country of Bhutan's model of happiness, which exists around 9 domains or areas of life. And these include things like health, mental health, education, culture, social connection, environment, government, time balance, and so forth. And so the Happy Counts website has a survey which people can go to and take. And that survey takes about 12 to 15 minutes to do, and it asks them questions in each one of these domains, questions which the psychology department at San Francisco State determined had the highest correlation to well-being. Using many, many surveys from around the world and drawing questions from those, they honed it down to what they think is the best way to get at this in a reasonable amount of time. So when you take that survey, you will immediately, when you're finished, get a score in each of these areas of life, and you will see what the national average is in the U.S. So you can compare yourself and you can think, you know, where might I need to make some changes in my life. You'll also get a basic happiness score and other things. I think it's fun for individuals because they can kind of, it asks them questions they don't normally ask themselves. Many find that they are very low in time balance, and they think about that, you know, that they are stressed, and it makes them more aware of it. But also for communities, we're finding that this is a great way for a community to judge how well it's doing and to think about what kind of policy changes could improve communities in the areas where they're weak. So it's a fun process. We've had about 40,000 Americans take this survey, and we have a lot of data.
That's interesting. Do you have international data to compare it to as well?
We have some, but we have international data relating to aspects of it, but not other aspects. But we certainly have lots of international data on the basic question about life satisfaction from Gallup and other organizations around that.
Just out of curiosity, and I don't know if you know offhand, but where people experience the most, the highest level of life satisfaction in the world?
In Denmark and in the Nordic, Northern European countries generally. The U.S. doesn't do badly in the current UN World Happiness Report 2013, which is out. The U.S. ranks 17th in the world. Denmark is number one. Nordic countries and the Netherlands are, and Switzerland, Canada are very high. The poorest countries, the lowest scores are in sub-Saharan Africa. It's what you might expect. But the U.S. does pretty well for adults. For kids, life satisfaction for kids and quality of life for kids in the United States is considerably worse in comparison to other countries than life satisfaction for adults and quality of life for adults. And this is a danger sign. It's a warning sign that we need to think about, that we are really, it's kids who are suffering. And one of the things we find in our happiness survey is that the least happy cohort of the American population are 20-somethings as adults. And that didn't used to be the case. It used to be that it was 40 and 50-somethings, that, you know, you were happy when you were young, in middle age when you had a lot of responsibilities and other things, happiness kind of, and then it started to go up again when you became a geezer like me, you know. So
interesting. And what's the thinking behind that for the 20-somethings? Is it because they're having a harder time finding meaning in their lives, or
well, they're finding it hard to find a lot of things. They're finding it hard to find jobs. They're finding it hard to pay back their debts because they've been saddled with immense debts because we now are not paying for education, higher education for them. I went to the University of California at Berkeley in the 1960s for $126 a semester. At that time, the leading public institution in the country. Today, it's going to be $15,000 a year. You know, I mean, it's a huge thing, and this leaves kids with a lot of debt, and then with not very good employment prospects, and with a essentially declining median income for 80% of Americans are seeing their incomes actually fall. This is a bad thing. Ultimately, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a bad thing to see incomes fall if we did some other things, if we saw time increase and not, but we're not. We're seeing work hours also increase while money goes, you know. It's not a good situation. And particularly, it's rough on kids. UNICEF did its report on the well-being of children in rich countries that came out this year. Looks at 29 rich countries, five categories: poverty, education, risky behaviors, environment, and one other that I'm forgetting. And then also kids' own subjective analysis, view of their well-being. The United States ranks 26th out of 29 rich countries, with only Lithuania, Latvia, and Romania falling below us. Didn't even come out in the press here. This is enormously significant. We are shortchanging our kids by comparison to other wealthy countries, and we will pay for that in the long run. Well, we have enormous rates of child poverty in comparison to other countries, 22%, you know, and big, we're not doing well in education. We have health and safety for American kids, very low in comparison to others, much higher, for instance, rates of infant mortality, low birth weight babies, teen pregnancies, you know, all kinds of things that you look at, we don't do as well as other rich countries by a long shot. And our kids rank themselves 23rd out of 29 countries in terms of how good they feel their lives are. So we do a little better there, but still we are far off from the Netherlands, which is the number one country for children, and the Scandinavian countries, which are fairly close behind.
You know, John DeGraff, we're running out of time, but I do have a couple more questions, one of which is, how much of this has to do with inequality?
Everything. In short, I mean, not everything, but inequality is the largest single factor that has been contributing to our decline relative to other countries over the past 30 years. We have seen an immensely increasing gap between rich and poor in the United States. We now have the widest gap by far in the rich world between rich and poor. We have the 1% or 2% or whatever seeing enormous gains in their wealth over this period of time, while the population is a whole sliding backwards, even despite the fact that we're twice as productive as we were then. People have not gained from this, and inequality drives all kinds of things. It drives consumerism as the expectations are higher from the people at the top. It drives overwork. People try to keep up. It drives debt. So inequality is huge, and in states that have relatively higher equality, and Utah is one of them. Utah actually does fairly well in many of these things. Utah has one of the smallest gaps between rich and poor of American states, and you can see that reflected in better health, in a happier population, and other things in this state. It's not the best, but it's up there in the top 10, you know.
John, I have just one more question, which is, given the studies you've done and your look at our sort of addiction to material gain, are you optimistic about the future, even of our species?
I don't know. You know, it depends on if we wake up in time. I mean, time's getting short, you know, and I'm not going to see the bad stuff, really bad stuff, happen because I'm 67 years old, so I... But I worry for my kid. I worry for my, I don't have any grandkids yet, but I worry for them because clearly the climate issue is coming unglued. I mean, it's really enormous. And I saw in USA Today cover story yesterday that Americans are starting to get this, that about 80% of Americans now really believe that climate change is a serious problem and is human caused. And that's a change. And I think that's happened because of these crazy weather events of the last few years. But we have got to deal with this. And we cannot let this inequality just grow without bounds. We have to figure a way to answer this. I don't know. There are many, many ways, and it would take far too long to get into them. But we need to take climate change and inequality seriously.
Well, John DeGraff, we appreciate your taking the time to speak with us today. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks very much. Glad to be on your program.
And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. That's all the time we have. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. We're on the program tuning for a conversation with Kathleen Kaufman, president of the Utah Nurses Association, on why Utah nurses are rallying behind federal Medicaid expansion. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening today. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.